it's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 469 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This time it's another doubleheader Kickstarter weekend with two favorites that are back again. First up is Rob Stanley from The Bite of Brenna Barlow. He's got a Kickstarter that starts today, and you can support the second book, the first of a three-parter in which Brenna goes to London. Rob catches us up on what's going on in the Brennaverse, and we talk about what kind of things he has planned for her in the future as well. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. Then everything wraps up with the return of Frank Martin, whose Kickstarter is already underway for The Polar Paradox. It's always great to talk with Frank, and we discuss the various parts of putting a comic together, as well as what we can expect in the final chapter of The Polar Paradox. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say as well. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Rob Stanley, one of the creators of The Bite of Brenna Barlow, which has, as of the day this posts, a new Kickstarter going. So how you doing, Rob?
Very good. Nice to talk to you again, Wayne.
Yeah, it's good to speak with you too. So why don't, for people who may have forgotten or maybe didn't get a chance to hear our previous interview, talk about who Brenna Barlow is.
The Bite of Brenna Barlow is about a telepathic, blind vampire who decided to use her power of telepathic, insight and the fact that she's a vampire to help the voiceless and to deal with the more sinister elements of the world.
Okay. And you've had one issue before this, right?
Yes, I had one issue. Well, actually, before that, I had a short story where she was introduced. It was actually in Tim West's Hollow Scream anthology in 2018. And then I fleshed it out into the first issue, which came out over the summer. And now this will be the second issue, which is actually the first issue of a three-issue arc.
Oh, okay. Very good. Now, the interesting thing about it, she is from London, right, originally?
She is from England. She's from a small little village called Houghton le Spring. That's where she – and then eventually when she grew older, she wound up in the States. But, yeah, she's from England.
And, of course, my favorite character of the whole business is, as refers on the cover of the next issue, is Gary the Derisive Dachshund.
Yeah, that's Gary. He wasn't in the original short story, but I wanted to bring some levity to the book. So in the first official issue, you see Gary and you see that she has a pet dachshund whom she can talk to through her mind. That's one of the he's the only animal she can actually read, but she and the dog have a lot of interesting conversations.
Yeah, you made a copy of what's going to happen in the next issue available to me, which I got a chance to read. And thankfully, Gary is still he's still Gary.
Yeah. He has some good one-liners in this one.
Yeah, he's quite a good thing. I'm always curious about this, and we did talk about some of these things before, so if I repeat something, I'm sorry about that. But is Gary based on a person? How did the personality of Gary come about?
Well, Gary is based on when my wife and I would say about 4 years into our relationship, we got a dachshund, a long-haired dachshund named Gary. He was like our first little baby, and just sometimes the way he would look at us or the way he would act, it was almost like I could actually, it was almost like you could see what he was thinking. And when I originally wrote the story, Gary was still with us, and but then about 2 years ago he passed away. So in the original issue, I did dedicate it to him. But yes, Gary is based on our late beloved Dachshund Gary.
Ah, he's a funny little guy. He's hilarious how he looks at things. You know, he's kind of the outsider watching things, and he has a very at the beginning of this the second book. She's watching somebody who is a television personality.
Yes. And
his response is funny.
Yeah.
About that. I get a kick out of that.
Yeah. He I don't know. I felt compelled, but one time, I believe it in this book, in this one or the next one, he actually has some moments where he kind of breaks the fourth wall down, and he kind of, you know, he's kind of like the person speak, like the character speaking to the audience a lot. You know, he's thinking what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm. Which is a lot of fun. That's one of the reasons I like him. Now, Brenna Barlow, she's based on, is she based on somebody? Is she a character that you developed? You know, what's she based on?
Well, originally He Said, She Said, which wound up becoming the short story in Tim West's Hollow Scream anthology back in 2018. It was an actual written short story that I did, that I saw that there was a Halloween themed comic anthology coming out. And I thought, well, you know what, I'll try my hand at adapting this into a short story. And it, you know, but as it came into the book, when I did the first full issue, I kind of fleshed her out of it. I kind of look wise, I based her on an actress on a British soap opera called Hollyoaks, blonde, little spunky blonde. Personality wise, I just wanted to make her strong. I wanted to make her very determined. She's not going to, you know, back away from anyone, despite, you know, the fact that she can't see, and, you know, she's a vampire, so certain things are, you know, she's a little weak too, but she is a very strong female character.
You know, the way that you write her and the way that she's illustrated, sometimes I forget that she's blind. And that's an interesting thing about the character. I mean, a vampire who's blind, that still strikes me as an unusual circumstance. We may have talked about this before, but why did you go that route with her?
Well, originally it was for the short story, and the way the story went, I wanted her to look like that she was perhaps unknowing to the unsavory desires of this character that was actually in the short story with her. And then in the end, there's a twist, and she, you know, you see that she was reading his mind, and he gets his comeuppance. But I wanted her to look as just as open as possible to someone possibly trying to pull one over on her.
And also, she's a little more vulnerable this
yes,
way.
Yes, yes.
She's not a high power vampire in the sense that she obviously depends on her hearing a lot, and some of that is revealed in the second comic, which I kind of like. But it does make her less of a, you know, vampires are kind of like Superman in many things, and it's nice to see her a little less invulnerable and stuff like that. So she actually has a lot of interesting things going on. Now, as far as being a vampire and stuff, where does she get, obviously she needs blood to sustain her. Where does she get that from?
She on animals, on different, like she on the prey, she preys upon unsavory people. She hears something that sounds unsavory, unhuman. Like in the first issue, there was a gang of villains that were dealing with this young girl. She preyed upon them. I'm trying to remember, there's really not, I kind of allude to things, but I try not to make it the stereotypical vampire story where she's just running around and feasting upon people. I mentioned it, but I want it to be more about who she is, her past, and how she tries to help others. And as you see in this new book, how there's a couple additions to the whole of the cast of characters of whom she interacts with, and how and what they mean to her, and how she interacts with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've talked about the two main characters, the Brenna and Gary. Who are the new characters that are in the new book?
Well, in the new book, a family matter involving her great-grandson, whom he doesn't know who she is. He thinks that she is just his mother's friend, like from a long time ago, or like the daughter of one of his mother's friends, but she's been caring for his mother for some time now. His mother is now her granddaughter is now 100 years old, but he isn't the most caring individual, and he basically wants to use his mother's money. So she's called upon to go back to London, back to England, where she is from, and deal with his solicitors, and because he wants to bring his mother back to the UK so he can have her money. And her coming back to the UK opens up a bunch of different story possibilities, and it introduces the great-grandson, Nathan, as well as who I actually enjoyed writing for this character, a new character by the name of Chantel, who is Brenna's friend. And in the book, you see when they first meet, because much like the first book, there are flashbacks in here. And she's going to live with her as she deals with this family matter. And to say that Chantel is unique would be putting it mildly.
She is funny. There's several things that times that when she meets Brenna at the airport, you know, she flings her arms around her and basically says, you know, what brings you in this neck of the woods and stuff like that. So she is a very outgoing character. She's a little different from Brenna in the sense that she's very self-confident in all the things that. Is she based on somebody, or is she
It's funny that it goes back again. It was kind of hard to tell probably in the copy I sent you, because my colorist, Rebecca McConnell, is still working on the colors. But, you know, she takes her back to her flat, and it's not in the best part of the neighborhood, but the house is like leopard print and everything. She's actually based, again, we're going to go back to that British soap, Hollyoaks. There's a family on there called the McQueens, which they're very colorful. They're not the highest class of people, but they're a very close-knit family, and they fight for each other. And the way I did the living room and her attitude, I got a lot from the McQueens, and I also wanted to give Brenna like more like a big sisterly type of relationship with someone, and I think it came off a lot better than I even thought it would with her and Chantel.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's so funny. I gotta ask you, there's a word that I can't quite make out on the cover, and I'm sure you can tell me. It says Chantel the cheeky
chav.
Okay.
It's a British slang. It's someone who they're not exactly the richest person, but they dress like they wear all like the nice clothes, the bling, and they act like they're hot stuff. And they have their little slang. But, you know, from the looks of it, you think, oh, they might have some. But in the reality, they live in some place kind of like Chantel's place. But they still act like they're, you know, the Windsors.
Mm-hmm. I always, like the first book, I always learned so much about British culture and, you know, and things like that go on there all the time, because you refer to things the way that the Brits do and things like that. And I always find that interesting because, you know, the way that they refer to things, the way the lift, we call it an elevator, they call it a lift. There's all different kinds of things that they do differently than we do. And I like knowing those kinds of things. I like being exposed to different cultures and understanding, you know, how they refer to things. Because you never know when that kind of thing comes in handy.
Yeah.
But if I remember correctly, you got into it through television, right?
Through television, and plus I have a lot of friends over in the UK. One friend in particular, in case he winds up listening to this, Carl, calls me the plastic Brit because I'm from America, but I like all things British. I sound British a lot. It's more or less I'm like an unofficial Brit. It's since I was young, but even nowadays where you can go and you can watch stuff on YouTube or stream different TV shows, I actually enjoy British entertainment more so than anything that's offered in the U.S. right now. And the whole slang thing and the different locales out there was a small reason as to why I shifted the story setting to the UK, because I just felt it like it would be more colorful that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the places that you refer to, they're real places, right?
Yes, yes. In fact, Houghtonly Spring is actually the way I came up with it was doing my ancestry. I found out that my father had great relatives that emanated from there. And I thought, well, that'd be different than just saying she's from the stereotypical London or Liverpool or whatever. So that's why I made her from that small village.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool. There are terms in there every once in a while I come across and I go, well, she calls Brenna you slag.
Yeah.
And what is that in British terminology? What does that mean?
That's like, just like drinking buddies would be like, ah, you slag, just kind of nudge. You know, it was basically a way to say that, you know, Chantel wasn't the most proper woman. You know, she could be seen as one of the guys, maybe. You know, she doesn't have a filter.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of fun. It makes her very different from Brenna. Brenna has a huge filter, it seems like. She's constantly being careful on what she says and who she's, you know, saying things to, which is kind of it makes the two of them very, you know, an odd couple.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. So that's kind of fun to read.
Yeah. And plus there's the, you know, her interaction. Well, not really interaction. Gary. You hear his thoughts. She doesn't know what he's thinking. The interaction between Gary and Chantel as well.
Mm-hmm. Funny stuff. Dude. Gary is such a character. He's such a fun guy. I like him. I'm always when he says something, I make sure that I pay good attention to it because it's always going to be funny.
Yeah,
it's always going to be a great thing. So how old is Gary in the book, by the way?
Gary, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, because I also did an origin story to see how Brenna and Gary met. And again, these origin stories, if any of the listeners, if they didn't get it, if they pledged last book and didn't get it, they will be offered again in a tier where you can get the origin stories, how Gary met Brenna, and also how Brenna met the villain that we're going to talk about later that's introduced in the story. Gary, I believe, is 4.
Okay. And dachshunds usually live until they're what?
Usually some of them. I mean, right now, my in-laws still have 2 of the original dachshunds that were raised with Gary. And I believe one is like 14 and one is 13. I mean, and my great-grandmother had a dachshund named Hines who lived till he was about 18 years old.
Wow. That's pretty good. Of course, I guess when you live that long, you can't help but get a little acerbic,
yeah,
in your attitude towards
and
things.
It's funny, the one thing that I've gotten ever since the first book, people, you know, asked me, I've had one person actually tweet this to me, tell me, oh, well, you're not going to kill Gary off eventually, are you? It seems like everyone just wants Gary to stay put. And I assure them, I said, as a promise to my wife, I'm never going to kill the dog off.
Because, you know, there was a strip in the daily paper called For Better or For Worse, and it went in real time, and they had a dog that was there. They got another young dog to replace the older dog, and the older dog was starting to slow down and stuff, and the lady who created that strip just knew there was going to be this outpouring, but in order for real life to go on, she had to have the dog pass. And she did it in a very heroic way. You know, the dog kind of sacrificed itself for a child or something.
Yeah.
And but still, the outpouring, oh, my gosh. Oh, how could you kill the dog? Oh, well, she said, I'm doing everything in real time. You know, the parents have been growing older, and the kids, we see them in, like, younger grades. And then when the strip was coming to an end, they were gone off to college and stuff like that. So – but she knew that was going to be a big deal when the dog passed, and she was right. Everybody kind of reacted like, oh, no, not that. you know, the old story about when you watch a movie, we don't care who dies as the humans, but as long as the dog survives, we're all right.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of stuff. So you know that you've, I'm sure, have.
Not only that, I mean, even like Gary has been like the breakout character from the book, even when I was talking to the guys from Comics on the Green about the book, and turns out they have their pet dachshund as their store mascot. And they're like, oh, and they're like, you know, you had us on dachshund because they had a dachshund.
Yeah, I see him on Facebook, and there's stuff there all the time. Now, I think I asked you this last time, and I wanted to see if it's true the same. I'm sorry to spend so much time on the dachshund, but it fascinates me. The drawings, are they based on pictures of dachshunds?
They're based on pictures of Gary.
Oh, okay, specifically.
That's what Gary looked like. Gary was a black and tan, long-haired dachshund. Although in this one, he's not much of a long-haired dachshund as he got a haircut from the groomer. That's why he even makes a comment about that when he sees Chantel for the first time.
Mm-hmm. He says something to the effect of, thank goodness you took me to the groomer.
Yeah.
Kind of fun stuff. He's so human in that sense. Okay, enough about the dachshund. Let's talk I could talk about dachshund all the whole thing, but I'm sure other people want to know about about Brenna and stuff like that. I think we discussed this before. I think it bears repeating. How old is Brenna at this point?
Brenna is about 140 years old.
Okay. Yeah. She looks like she's how old though?
She looks like she's in her like late 20s. And I did some research on this, and it said like typically in the whole lore, most of the lore with vampires, that they age like so many years every 20 years. So I thought, well, that put her like in her 20s or 30s, and that's good enough.
And I noticed she still has the same job that she did in the first book.
Well, she had the same job there, but now she's going to be over in the UK, and it's not touched upon in this book, but later on she will get a new vocation that will be interesting to say the least. But now this book is more or less about her settling into the UK, introducing Chantel, and just the differences of how it is living there and why she's there and things that happen when she's over back home.
Now, you said this is a 3-issue story arc, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. This chapter is called London Calling, obviously, because she's coming back to the UK, specifically London. But the whole story arc is called Timeless Time, because as readers will see, things from the past are going to come into the present and affect Brenna in ways that she'd never imagine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's something to look forward to. So I'm interested as to a three-parter. Was there a reason why you wanted to go three-parter? Did the story just warrant it? Or was that because you did a one-parter for the first? Did you want to go someplace new?
Well, I mean, when I wrote the first one, it was kind of almost like, you know, you're writing the pilot of a TV show. And I wrote it, and it was there. And there were certain things that once it was there for me to look at, and once it was there for me to hear feedback from people who read it and read reviews, because, I mean, I was floored at the number of reviews that I got on, like, Goodreads and different places that reviewed it. I kind of tweaked things and saw certain things that worked and certain things that might, you know, maybe weren't as interesting. And that's what took her to the UK. And I'm thinking, well, if she's going to go back home, it should be something, a story that isn't just contained in one issue. It should be something that is kind of fleshed out a bit because she is going back home. There should be things back home that make the story different than if, you know, when she was in Townington, Maryland, my fictional little Maryland town that I created for the first book. So that's why I fleshed it out. And each of the three issues for this story are kind of have a different feel. Like this one is like a homecoming. I can tell you the second one is more like just, again, going more, a stronger feeling of the timeless time, flashbacks, things that come back that she doesn't want to come back, things that come back that she might be a little bit more pleased to accept back into her life. And then I can tell you right now, the third chapter of this story arc is just no holds barred insanity.
Okay, something to look forward to. Now, people always get mad at me because I don't do this soon enough. On the day that this podcast posts, it's when the Kickstarter starts. Do you know when it's going to conclude at this point? Because you were doing this a little ahead of time.
Well, I used to know when this was. You mean the story itself?
No, I mean the Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter, it starts at midnight on. Well, this is going to be Sunday the 17th. I believe it's going for 21 days. It's sometime in February. Okay. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it's sometime in mid-February. Either mid-February or like the second week of February. But it's going for at least 20 days.
Okay, so the Kickstarter is probably the best source of when it's going to
conclude. Yes.
So, okay, that'd be good. Because, you know, these things, unfortunately, shift sometimes when you're, you know, before you actually get up and going. So we don't want to say something that's inaccurate and have people go, wait a minute, you said this. But we don't want to get into that kind of good stuff. But the one thing you mentioned about timeless time that made me think, because, you know, when I've seen things over in the UK, a lot of the time it seems like things don't age or change as quickly as they do here in the States.
No.
Because, you know, I've seen stories, like, for example, there was a story about a family that killed all these different people and stuff. And they showed their home, and I looked at it, and I went, wow, that kind of looks like it's been there for a long time.
Yeah.
And they showed it in the current time, and it didn't look very much different. So it's interesting how their culture is a little different from ours, because we're used to things changing. I mean, if you don't go to a neighborhood, you know, in a quick moving community, you know, you go around the block and all of a sudden you haven't been there for a week or something. There's a whole new building there or something. But in the UK, it doesn't seem like that kind of thing happens very often. It tends to stay in place a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's refreshing in a way sometimes, at least seeing it from my perspective as being over in the U.S., you know, it's nice. It's nice to see.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's times I miss that. I mean, you know, when things change so fast that I can't keep up with it, I'm like, wait a second, when did that change? But over there, you don't get that kind of thing. And I think that has a lot to do with how they look at things, life and business and things like that. And that we're in a huge rush all the time, running. And for them, it's kind of like, well, you know, we don't have to really rush that hard, you know, to do things like that. And that's it, you know, people who are used to that and who like that pace, that's where they feel the most comfortable. You know, there's times in here in the U.S. I wish we weren't going at that pace, to be honest. But that's kind of the way we do that. But it's interesting to see her, you know, Brenna's, now that she's back in her home turf, basically, how she's looking at things and how that. See, now you've got me puzzled. I need to know about her change in profession. Brenna has been a telephone, like salesperson.
Yes.
In the first issue.
Yes.
Now I got to know, and of course I don't want to be spoiled, but now I'm curious now. I want to know where does she go from there? That will be an interesting development I want to see. Does this take place while she's in the UK, or is it when she comes back? I don't tell me what, but does this happen over the course of the three issues?
Yes, it does. Obviously, you know, leaving Townington, she had to leave her job at the call center, but once things settle down, Chantel does hook her up with a new job, although it's not exactly what she thought it would be, and it leads to at least a little bit of fun. I'm sure a lot of people will find it amusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm puzzled. I'm interested to know where you're going to take her with that, because that'll be something interesting to see. I do that now. I don't want to spoil too much in this book, because I want people to be able to read it like I do and get to enjoy it like that. But you did bring up something that I want to be sure we talk a little bit about. But you talk about the antagonist,
yes,
for Brenna, who comes up. Now, do you want to talk a little bit about that? What should we know about that person that doesn't spoil too much?
He is someone from Brenna's far, far back past. We're talking when she was still a late teenager, and she's still quite young. He's an unwanted presence in her life then, and he's going to be an unwanted, even more unwanted presence in her life now. And it takes her coming back to England that brings him back into her life. And he's not a vampire. I will say he's not a vampire, but he is something otherworldly.
Okay, so something in the supernatural realm.
I will say that if anyone got the Origins tier in the first Kickstarter, they saw him and they know exactly what he is. And if you want a little bit more of a glimpse into who he is, there, as I said before, there will be another Origins tier where you can read these short origin stories PDFs that I will send that kind of offer insight into just a little thing that you want. Like, a lot of people ask, well, how did Brenna and Gary meet? And a lot of other people ask, well, okay, Brenna's out in the daylight. How is that possible? She's a vampire. That's touched upon in the story that also introduces this unwanted individual.
Okay. See, that makes me want to ask, why is he unwanted? But I'm afraid that'll spoil something.
Well, so years ago, when she was a young girl, Brenna loved someone very, very much. And this person had a connection to this unwanted individual. And there's a good chance that this unwanted individual permanently made it so Brenna and this person could not be together.
Okay, that sets that all up pretty well. I think that's a good way to do it without giving too much away. So yeah, I because Brenna seems to, you know, when she was back in the first issue and she was working with somebody who was being abused,
yes,
a coworker, and I got a sense from her that because she's able to, you know, I don't know how far we want to go with it, but she's able to kind of perceive what's going on with somebody else. And if they're in trouble, she tries to help them, which is not always the way vampires act. So I was kind of really intrigued by that she seems to be somewhat sympathetic for that. And of course, that you have to go, it would seem, a long way to really get her on her bad side. So that makes me think that this guy has done something really awful
for that to happen. Brenna is a tortured soul, and a lot of that goes back to the relationship she had with her father, which touched upon in a scene or two in the first book. But a lot of it goes back to this, I'm going to say it again, I'm going to call him an unwanted individual. And he kind of set the course for her just caring more about others than herself, because once lose that one thing, one person in your life that you thought was going to be that one person in your life, she just would much rather care for others rather than care for herself, caring about this any other person.
Now, of course, that opens up a door. You talked about the father and stuff. The thing that interests me, while she's in the UK, are we going to get to explore her family and her background like that? Is that something that's going to happen over these three issues?
Well, yeah. Like the first issue had a lot of flashbacks to her dad and when she gave birth to her daughter and different things like that. This one is probably the issue with the least amount of flashbacks. I don't even think there, you know what, there are a few, but not as many. But as you go on, you kind of see not really her father, although he's kind of mentioned, but you see how as a young teenage girl, the relationship she had with this guy who she thought was the one, and then there was that unwanted individual who decided to, you know, nix that.
So we got some interesting things to. So we're gonna obviously we're gonna explore that part.
That's the one thing. The one great thing about the switch in setting is because it made it easier for me to kind of touch upon these things within the realm of the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, there's things that I'm interested in that I don't dare ask about. Does she stay in the UK? I mean, she gets a different job. I don't know if I should even ask that question, because that would give away probably the end of the third issue. So I don't want that. I want to be able to read the issue and enjoy it.
It doesn't have really any bearing in, I mean, for the foreseeable future, the setting of The Bite of Brenna Barlow will be England, will be her homeland.
Okay. Well, that's interesting, because that's a shift. That's quite a, you know, I'm curious, though, why make a shift like that? Because you set her all up in Maryland and had the whole thing all going and, you know, spent a good deal of the first issue dealing with Maryland, and now we go over to the UK.
It made it easier to touch upon her past and do different elements of her past and her life and introduce certain characters who kind of brought more to the story rather than her being an outsider. Because that's basically when she was in Townington, with the exception of the neighbor that you briefly see in the first issue, she was more or less like a loner in the UK. Now that she's moved back and she's in London, she has Chantel. She doesn't get along with her great grandson, but she has him to play off of. Then you have this unwanted individual. You just have different things in the UK that kind of are more of a natural fit for her than just being in a small Maryland town.
See, that's interesting, because, you know, most American comics stay in America. Now, it's interesting to actually see somebody go over to the UK and tell a story from the UK. That's good. Of course, you know, that your interest in the UK and your familiarity with the culture and stuff like that, of course, makes it interesting and easy for you to do that. How do you think people are going to respond to that? Do you think that the fans of the book are going to be glad that that happened? I'm just kind of curious as to making that change.
Well, I mean, as funny as it sounds, ever since the first Kickstarter, I've probably 80% of the feedback that I've gotten has been from readers in the UK. And it's partially due to the fact that my friend Andrew, who lives in Newcastle, when the Kickstarter was going on, I was still like a Twitter virgin. I had no idea how to use Twitter. I had no idea how it worked. And he was like my hype man. He was plugging the Kickstarter every which way. And I was getting so much feedback and so many backers from the UK. And then once everyone got the book or got, you know, the digital version sent to them, I got so many different reviews from the UK. And all those people were saying, well, when are you coming out with the second one? I want to tell my friend about this one or that one. And it kind of the way, and even before then, I had this switch instead setting in mind. And then as I'm getting this feedback, I'm thinking, wow, this is just the perfect fit, because it seems like, I mean, I have a lot of readers from the States, but the majority of them have been from the UK or have been readers in the US who love British comedy or stuff like Doctor Who Blake Seven, you know, like they like British things. So it really seems like this switch in setting is kind of a fit to the way the feedback has come.
And, you know, it'll also make it make your book stand out as something a little different. Because, you know, I mean, Marvel, everything in the Marvel universe takes place in New York City.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, of course, DC, they have all their own individual cities. But the thing that's interesting to me, I like to see things in a different sense. I think, see, that's one of the reasons I think Doctor Who is so popular over here is because it's something of different to see something that they don't have ray guns and they don't go punching and kicking all over the place. They approach things from a very different perspective than we do. And that's quite a nice change of pace. And I think that this comic is going to benefit from that because here are people, you know, in a culture that's a little different from ours. And it's going to be an experience that we don't get in many American comics. So I think that's a real selling point.
Yeah, and I try to stay as genuine as possible, drawing upon what friends of mine in the UK have said to me, the feedback they've given. I didn't want it to be, as my one friend in the UK says, I didn't want to be Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins. You know, I wanted to be as genuine as possible. So if you happen to be from the UK and you were reading this character talking, or you saw this setting, or you saw this something mentioned from over there, it didn't seem forced or out of place.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really cool because, you know, like I said, I like to discover other things about other cultures and stuff like that. So for me, it's a real educational book. And it's also, like I said, the setting is different. The people function a little differently. I hear words that I don't necessarily know. What I can always do these days, thanks to the internet, I can go out there and say, what is that word? And I'll go out there and find that what that really means and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, we hear a lot of wanker and things like that. We get those kinds of words. And I didn't know what they meant until somebody pointed out what they mean.
And not only the words, like I wanted, like, and there's a flashback to how Brenna meets Chantel, and I wanted something because Chantel at that time was, you know, like an elementary school age girl. So this would take it be like the late 90s, early 2000s, and I wanted it to be something mentioned that would be airing in that time in the UK. And I even asked my friends, I think I posted on Facebook, what was a big deal back then in Saturday night TV over there, just so I could stay accurate and stay genuine. Because the one thing, there's a show on TV called The Goldbergs. And what drives me up a wall about that show is they're very just general when it comes to the things that they mention. It's supposed to be taking place in the 1980s, but in one episode they'll mention the original Batman movie with Michael Keaton, and then in the next one. And then in the next episode, they'll mention how Gremlins just came out. And I that drives me up a wall. So I try to stay as genuine as possible. And especially when it comes to this, like, and there's a mention of a British TV show, British personality that was big in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. I had to look that up because I didn't know who in the world that was.
Yeah.
So I had to look it up. So I like those kinds of things. A lot of people say, I don't know who that is. I'm going to stop reading the book. Well, I'm just the opposite. I want to know who that is. So I actually look it up and find out more about it.
Yeah.
So that's one of the great things about this book. And you're right. The genuineness is really kind of fun for me because I get to find out things I didn't know. And I always like that.
Yeah. There was that. You were probably thinking of the line that Chantel has at the end when she says a certain personality was in everything, and it happened to be, I wanted to mention a favorite British comedian of mine who pretty much is in everything, who is basically like the, I don't know who you would think of who's on TV here, who's in everything, but think of like a comedy version of Ryan Seacrest. Well, that was what this guy was, and I wanted to mention him. I'm like, oh, that would make sense given the time and place. So, and it really added genuine, you know, like this girl who's from England would mention, well, is it this guy? Because he's a big personality on British television.
Mm-hmm. It's really fun. So those are kind of, and then of course you mentioned places like the cross-eyed panda.
Yes.
And stuff like that. Those are all real places. And it's, you know, as I bump into them, I say, I got to look that up. And I go on the internet and find out about it. So to me, I like to do that. I like to experience different things.
Yeah.
And to learn those things. So I think your comic is really great about that. And you, like I said, Brenna is a very different vampire from what I'm used to. So it, this whole experience, and of course, the dachshund who I love so much, and all these different elements make this a very unique story for me. And I like something that I haven't read before. So that's one of the things. I highly encourage, if you didn't get the first issue, you'll have that too as part of the Kickstarter, right?
There will be a tier where it's like a catch up where you could get all the, you know, the first issue as well as the origins and whatnot. That'll be offered as well. There's a lot more different tiers of this. I tried to offer even more than the first one just to keep a wide variety out there, because I know different people like different things when they go on to Kickstarter. So I tried to keep it wide open.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the book goes, do you know when it's going to be ready for release, the first issue?
If it's anything like, I mean, last Kickstarter ended the beginning or middle of August, and I already had the majority of the books out to everyone by mid to late September. And I'm kind of hoping it's the same thing. I mean, granted, with what's going on here, the mail's not as reliable as it was back in August, but I'm still hoping to get everything as quickly, and because like I said, everything is pretty much done. Like, I'm waiting for Rebecca, my colorist, to do the colors, but you probably by the 15th of this month, everything will be pretty much in the can, and just have to wait to add little bits and pieces after the Kickstarter. Like, I like to put like dedications to people who have contributed and whatnot. And it's almost ready to go.
Great. But I wish other people did that. I did some Kickstarters that I have backed. I haven't seen in years. I've been waiting for some stuff. So that's great to have that. Now, of course, that leads to the next question. Okay, three-parter. This is the first part. You're aiming for that to be done pretty quickly.
Yes.
Do you know, have you got in your mind, have you got set for like the second part? Do you know when you're going to go with that?
The second part, I mean, if it's anything like the timeline that we've been going with this, you figure, okay, this will end in February. Everything will probably be out by March. I probably will go sometime in the summer, like I did last summer. I'm trying to do it like winter, summer, you know.
Okay. So that'll be something to look forward to for the summer.
Yes.
Of course, this being a three-parter now, are you looking for next winter then for the third part?
More or less, yeah. I will say, and this is partly due to great people behind podcasts like you, and I did a lot better than I thought I ever would for my first Kickstarter. And a couple weeks ago, Kickstarter prematurely put this Kickstarter out. I mean, I since had it backed up, but in the 2 minutes that it was out, I already made $250.
Goodness.
There are people waiting, and it really does my heart good. And you're talking about like future books. Yes, then I'm shooting for like next winter. And then after the third part, there is a fourth book. Now, originally I intended that to be the last one. I wanted to, you know, beginning, middle, and end. I didn't want anything. And then my wife, who I often sit and discuss things with and mention little story, and I mentioned the little elements of the story, and she's like, yeah, but if that's the case, what if you do this, this, this? And I'm like, you know, when you say this to a writer, you're opening up Pandora's box for other issues. So, yeah, now it's the end, ?
Okay, well, you know, if this is a success, why mess with success? Why don't you, if there's other stories you'd like to tell with the character and you're setting things up in a good way, I don't know why you would want to end it. You can go off and do other projects in between and stuff like that, but if Brenna Barlow is doing this well and you've got stories to tell, then I would say keep it up.
And just her mentioning that one little what if that just opens up a whole new can of worms. And I will say that it made me do little, you know, fantasy outlines. So, I mean, on my flash drive, there's a lot of stuff that could possibly be used.
Cool. Well, see, that's a good thing, though. That's when you know a story has legs, that something comes along and it opens up a door and you go, oh, I could do this. I could do that. That's good stuff. And it sounds like Brenna Barlow has got a future that's going to be a lot of us can enjoy and look forward to. So let me once again say it's called The Bite of Brenna Barlow. It's number two. What was the subtitle again?
London Calling.
London Calling. Okay, so that's something to look forward to. And it should be out as of the day that this posts, which is Sunday. And let me make sure, because we're doing this a little ahead of time, I want to be sure I get it right. Sunday the 17th. Yep. You want to make sure and look, go to Kickstarter. And if you haven't gotten notified already, look for The Bite of Brenna Barlow out there and get to do it. Now, I did talk about Brenna Barlow and stuff like that. Are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of, or is this kind of keeping you busy?
Well, I mean, right before this, I was in a Clulu anthology. I did another story for Tim West's Hollow Scream this year. I did... and there are different things that are out there that I just submitted a pitch to a story about the end of the world that might, you know. So I'm not just sticking to this. Like, what happened was last year, I got sick. I got sick really, really bad. I was laid out for a whole month in November of 2019. I couldn't even watch my kids. I was just so sick. Some my doctors even kind of insinuate I might have had like an early strain of COVID. And I just stayed home. And while my wife was at work and the kids weren't there, all I really could do was write. So I, like I said, I have a flash drive just chock full of just things waiting for the right anthology or the right publisher, where if I see something pop up, I send it right to them.
Great. So, well, it's good that your creativity is getting an outlet and you're being able to do these good things.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Now, if somebody wants to follow you on social media, what's the best way to do that?
Okay. Well, on Twitter, I am, hey, it's Mr. Stanley. And then just look, if you're on Facebook, just look for my author page. It is just look for Rob Stanley and you'll see me with my shades on there. And you can like that. But mostly I've been doing a lot more on Twitter, thanks to the tutelage of Mr. Andrew Dixon, my friend in Newcastle. So I've been trying to get a lot of my stuff just out there, feedback from other artists, other authors. I have put together a great squad of creative people, like not just my artist, Greg Ronchak, and my letterer, Tobin, and my colorist, Rebecca McConnell. I've also found great artists who have done special covers for the book. Like in this one, there is going to be a special Kickstarter cover of Brenna Barlow, London Calling, where it's a little homage to Abbey Road, the famous Beatles album. And that
I saw that somewhere. I was looking through, you sent a copy of the thing to it and it's got that Abbey Road cover. I got to have a look at that. It's kind of cute stuff too.
And that was done by a very talented horror artist by the name of Benjamin Philby, who did a mini poster for the last Kickstarter, and he did this and he just hit it right out of the park with this, because not only is it a little homage to Abbey Road, there are a couple Easter eggs in there that Benjamin put in himself regarding some vampire TV shows stories and whatnot, that if you have a keen eye you could see.
Very cool. Very cool. So again, it's The Bite of Brenna Barlow, the number two, and you want to make sure you get to the Kickstarter, which as of the posting of this podcast, you will be able to support. And please do, because I enjoyed the first one tremendously. What I've seen of the second one looks great too. And I think this has the legs to go on for several more years, and As long as you've got the good ideas and the good stories, let's keep it going, because I think this is a great, fun, very different kind of storytelling. So I really like it, Robin. All I can say is I think you've got a good idea going here, and you've got great storytelling happening. So I hope this continues on for as long as you want it to.
Thank you so much for having me on, Wayne. And you know what? I wouldn't have gotten as much interest from people if it wasn't for you and everyone who supported me in the first one. And I want to thank everyone, and thank you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always a pleasure to talk with Frank Martin, the creator of such great things as Macabre Motel and Modern Testament. And he's got a new Kickstarter going on right now for The Polar Paradox. How you doing, Frank?
Hey, Wayne, thanks for having me on again. I think I've been chatting with you for every single project I've had, which is kind of cool.
Well, I always like to say that Kickstarters are a podcaster's best friend. Because what happens is that, you know, people are looking for advertising, and we get it done that way. And I get to advertise your stuff, and I get to talk about it too. If you had to pay for all this time, you know, if we go 45 minutes or 20 to 45 minutes, that would kind of cost a little bit. So I always feel like it's contributing towards your project. So that's one thing I want to do.
I love podcasts because it's not intrusive advertising, you know, and I'm not putting my project in front of people's faces out of the blue or randomly. If somebody's listening to a podcast, it's because they want to be listening to it. So you have a little bit of a captive audience to pitch yourself to. And that's why I love it so much, you know?
Well, it's a good thing because, you know, you're right in that people have to want to. There are some people who listen to podcasts no matter who is on there or what they're talking about. What I try really hard to do, though, is make it interesting that people who may not know about this stuff would want to learn about it, too. So that's my goal, is to get people who may not know much about it to decide, oh, I might want to look into that.
Well, what I mean is nobody clicks play on a podcast by accident and just said, oh, I'll just sit here for 40 minutes and listen to this thing. You know, it's because they're interested in whatever's going on. So you already got a foot in the door, and you just got to kind of make it worth their while.
Well, good. Well, I'll buy that. So let me read the description as it is on the Kickstarter page. It says, when research scientists go missing, an elite team of rescue divers head under Antarctica to unravel a mystery at the end of the Earth, which is pretty cool. Now, one of the things I noticed, and I always am surprised when I come across it, although apparently you're doing this more than other people, you've got a theme song for this.
I do, yeah. I got the idea because I've seen other people do it, and I'm fortunate enough that I have an old buddy of mine that I used to work with making movies with who scored my movies, and his name is Lane Thomas, and I kind of reached out to him. I hadn't spoken to him in a bunch of years, and I said, you still making music? And he said, yeah. And I said, I got comics that I'm crowdfunding. If I shoot it over to you, can you give it a read and try to create a song for it? And he did that for the Macabre Motel. And he said, let me know if you want to change anything. And I said, no, it's perfect exactly the way it is. He does a great job, like just giving me exactly what I want. And then I got all these other projects that I'm launching this year and next year. So I said, can I do like a package deal with you where I have like 5 books and you make theme songs for all of them? And he said, sure, absolutely. So this is kind of the first one of that package. And I think he did a great job with this one too.
I actually have pledged for it already. I was trying to be the first one, but I think I ended up being number 2. But the level that I selected, interestingly, was the theme song level.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I hope you dig the music, because there's kind of 2 sides to this story. You know, there's the adventure side, and then there's the mystery side. And I think he really – he hit the nail in the coffin and hit the nail on the head for both of these. You know, it's kind of the way the music is, it's kind of mysterious, but then it goes into like an underwater James Bond kind of feel to it, you know? So it's, I like the way he bounced back and forth.
Now, one of the things, you let me read this a little early, and you asked me to provide what I thought about it. And it's actually, if you go to the Kickstarter page for The Polar Paradox, you'll see my quote in there. And I'm going to quote myself for once. It says, "The Polar Paradox gives me the shivers, and it's not just the frigid temperatures that does it." So it's a very interesting book. I mean, it's... on some levels, it's 180 degrees away from the Motel Macabre and all that good stuff. So although there's still some horror elements in it, so horror is something that you clearly do well. So I shouldn't be surprised that this is another horror story, but a different setting.
Yeah. I mean, I would classify it more as like suspense. You know, it's the main characters are in danger. So it's not really meant to be scary in that sense, or meant to unsettle anybody. It's just meant to get your adrenaline pumping in more of an action-packed kind of way.
See, I like suspense more than I do horror. Horror to me is when you measure the blood by the gallons. Suspense is when I don't know what's going to happen and I want to know.
That's a good way of putting it.
So I like that about this. So you talked about how this story came to be. I've given a little bit of it. I want to get back to the story more. But you talked about how this idea came to you on the Kickstarter. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
So I was chatting with an artist that I met at a convention. His name was Antonio. He ended up being the co-creator on this book. And we said, we were trying to work on a project together. So I had to come up with some pitches for him, a couple bit different ideas. And one of the ideas I had came to me while I was reading National Geographic. And, you know, the story is basically about, it's the same premise as the book. A bunch of research scientists off the coast of Antarctica go diving. And they take a whole bunch of pictures in this uncharted sea that nobody's ever been to before. You know, they're documenting plant life and animals that evolved on paths that nobody ever thought of, that no humans have ever laid eyes on. And I said, this is a perfect setting for a comic book sci-fi adventure. And I just kind of added the extra premise of now these scientists go missing and you got to get divers to go in after them. And I pitched it to Antonio, and he immediately started working on designs for the creatures and the suits and the submarine and stuff like that. So after I pitched the idea, it kind of just wrote itself in a way, and the project just kind of came to life. And before you know it, we were running a Kickstarter.
And this is a two-parter, right? This is actually the first chapter.
Yes. It's a two-part story. First part, as we mentioned, is running now. And the second one should be running in the summertime, like June, July-ish.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting time to do a polar paradox, is in the middle of the summer.
Well, that's why it's paradoxical.
Okay. That is one thing I've always noticed about your writing, is you always like unique settings.
Yeah.
The motel was a really unique setting, although it was something I could relate to because I've had to stay in motels like that. But this, I have never been, I mean, I've gone in the water, but I've never gone into places where I've never, you know, where other odd life forms are and stuff like that. So I can't relate to this so much. But on the other hand, everybody wants to go scuba diving at some point. So on that level, I can. You know,
I think you give me too much credit, Wayne. I might have came into that by accident.
Okay.
But you know what? It was maybe there was some subconscious level. That's why I found it appealing, you know, because a lot of people relate this story to space. You know, they're going into uncharted territory where no man has ever gone before, and they have to survive on a mission, which is definitely similar to space. But at the same time, the ocean is so much more familiar to us. You know, people have gone to the beach, they put their feet in water. Even if they've never been to the ocean, they could have been in a lake where you don't see the bottom and you have no idea what's below you. So not many people have floated through the vacuum of space, but plenty of people have been swimming in the ocean. So it's, even though it's so alien and it's so unfamiliar diving into this foreign part of the sea, there is still a part of it that we know and we can relate to.
Now, the one thing that intrigued me about the artwork, are the outfits, the scuba, that's not scuba gear. It's almost like a spacesuit that they're wearing when they go down into the water.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting because it is, there's a lot of high tech going on. Apparently.
Yeah. So it's, this story is very much grounded in reality. You know, it definitely leans more toward the science aspect of science fiction. That said, it is a, it is in the near future, so I do take some technological liberties that they got futuristic suits and they got some futuristic tech that makes a storytelling a little bit easier so that it can overcome some obstacles, you know, if their suit gets ruptured or if they need to defend themselves, you know, they got more fantastical tools at their disposal.
Yeah, because I, you know, when I was a kid, I used to love Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Mm-hmm. That was a great show. That was a – it was very similar to space stuff in a sense, but they were underwater and there too, and they kept coming across unusual beings and stuff like that.
There's tons of examples, you know, like 40,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That movie Sphere was another good one. I think that was a Michael Crichton book. Also, they just came out with that movie with Kristen Stewart underwater where she kind of fights some monsters, the classic movie The Abyss. So, yeah, there's – really been some people that love to tell some great underwater stories.
Yeah, that's great. Jeff Lemire did an underwater thing about a diver one time that was really kind of interesting. Of course, his thing is more on relationships than it is about suspense. You know, people doing things, and when they finally interact with each other, we get to see how they do stuff, and it's always it's that focus instead of this. So, but I like different kinds of stories. So, when I read this, I was really intrigued by, you know, the number one, the cold down there, of course, the polar, it lends to that. But I live in Florida, and there's a good reason for that because I despise the cold. I was born and raised in Pennsylvania, and let me tell you, the first chance I got, I was out, and I was in a warmer region because, you know, I only had one green Christmas when I was growing up. Every other one was a very white Christmas. So from – I was – the first time I had a Christmas without snowing, I was like, yes, oh, yes. So for me, this kind of stuff is the cold – it strikes me, you know, because I try seriously to avoid the cold.
Yeah, there's a bunch of details in the National Geographic story that really stood out to me. And one of them was the writer was describing what would happen if the water actually touched their body. Because, you know, they're in dry suits, so they don't actually feel the water. But the water there is so cold that it, like, would sear your nerve endings shut. You know, it will send your body into a state of paralytic shock. And I kind of ripped that, and I use it in the story as in kind of a sense where they describe what will happen to them. So, yeah, diving down there, it ain't no joke.
No, it's terrifying, really. And you're right, in the suspense thing, there's that extra peril. You know, it's like when they go into space, they can't let the spacesuit get cut or anything because all the oxygen will go out. And this is an opposite thing where if it gets cut, the water will come rushing in. And that's a bad news thing. And of course, I'm kind of interested too in the sea creatures. There's eels and stuff like that. And then you show them a lot on the Kickstarter page. And
yeah, my project image is an eel.
Yeah. And it's just kind of, eels bother me.
they're too snake-like.
Yeah. I don't get what they think and what they do. I just don't get it. I mean, they can be looking at you one second, next thing all of a sudden they're right after you. And I don't get the reason why. And that's kind of the scary part about them. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're so, about suspense.
You know, it's great because I throw so many animals in this. I did a live stream the other day. The guy kept coming back to the squid. I couldn't get over the squid. The squid was driving me crazy. And then I talked to another guy, and he's like, the jellyfish were incredible. So it's like everybody's got their own little part of it.
Yeah, so there's something that bothers us. That's about it. See, squids don't bother me. I don't think squids are not likely to be too nasty. You know, and even if they grab a hold of you, I don't know that they're going to be so strong that they're going to be able to crush us and stuff like that. But an eel scares me. That's a thing that bothers me. So I'll go on. I'll be the eel guy.
That's fine. So yeah, the animals was a very cool aspect of the of the story. For the National Geographic, what I did was I took a bunch of screenshots from it, the actual photographs of the creatures that were down there, and I sent it off to Antonio, and I said, look, come up with some designs, you know, let your imagination run wild. These are familiar creatures so that we know them, like eels and squids and jellyfish, and sharks. But at the same time, they evolved on their own trajectories. They're in a part of, they're an isolated part of the ocean where they had free reign to evolve however they wanted. So don't feel constrained to limit yourself to how they look and how they act. And he did a phenomenal job, you know, on that, especially on that double page spread where the sea opens up and we see the plant life and the crabs and all that stuff. So it's, I think he did a phenomenal job with the setting and the scenery.
It's on some levels, it's beautiful.
It is. It is. The colors really pop too, which is awesome. I think he, as a practical side of the story, we needed to light it, and we didn't have any natural light, no sunlight. So we used a lot of bioluminescence with these creatures in the form of the colors that Antonio colored himself.
Yeah, it's gorgeous artwork. It really is something. It's really well done. Now, of course, what makes this story compelling are the people. The people are involved. If we relate to them, and you do a great job of making us care about these people, when that goes on, we've got the scientists who have disappeared. We've got the people going after them to rescue them and stuff like that. There's, if you look on the Kickstarter page, there's obviously what's a double cover spread.
Yes.
The first cover has the three rescuers.
Yes, it's a connecting cover that Antonio did, which is pretty cool. The first part one has the three rescue divers, and then part two has the scientists.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to get into it too much, but one of the scientists looks different than the others.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that.
Okay, we'll get to that later. Well, probably that's when we get to part two. We'll discuss all that.
You know what? I didn't think about that too much. People aren't going to really notice when they're glancing at it, but since you've read the book, it hits you a little bit more than and somebody that's just kind of scrolling through.
Now, why don't you talk about the three characters the rescuers in this book? Who are they? And you know, what is it about them that makes them so compelling?
So we got three rescue divers. Their names are Yu, Linda, and Greg, and they pretty much just embody the archetype of this various group, and they kind of take on their role. Yu is kind of the leader. You know, he's the one that takes charge and drives the team forward. Greg is the snarky one. He's always got a sarcastic comment. He's a little bit cocky. And Linda is kind of more the heart, the emotional center of the team that keeps them glued together.
Now, why do they take on this mission? Are they assigned to it? Are they familiar with the scientists? Why do they do it?
So they're part of like a group, you know, like let's say in this near future, they're a part of like a militaristic team that an SOS is sent out, and they're the closest unit in the area. So they're the ones that are deployed on the mission to get them. And originally, the way the story kind of unfolds, and you find this out in the first couple pages, is that these rescue, the scientists are only supposed to go on their reconnaissance mission for an hour. They were supposed to go down there. They have a guy's topside on a boat in the surface, and they're going to go down there, take some pictures, document the cave system that they go into, and head back. But after 3 hours, they haven't surfaced, and they call for an SOS. They call for a distress because they find something. We don't really know what they find because their SOS gets cut off. But they say they found something incredible, and they need some help. And it kind of it cuts off right as they're describing what's going on. And so there's a little bit of intrigue there. What did they find? What did they discover? And this kind of, it happens so suddenly that the divers say, look, there's a chance that even though they were down there for so long, they sent out this message. They might still be alive. Let's go in after them.
Mm-hmm. And it's done really well. You know, the you take us stage by stage through their trying to rescue, and they go through the different parts of the water and learn stuff. And I really like that because, in a sense, we're with them. Like we're shoulder to shoulder with these people, and we're seeing the stuff that they encounter. And so that helps us, you know, relate to what they're doing, because we can experience that. I think, you know, your story and I think the art really do a great job of pulling us in and making us feel like we're really there.
Yeah. The story structure and the pacing for this book really wrote itself based on the plot. You know, it was kind of bang, bang as far as sequence of events. We have the divers go missing. I should say the scientists go missing. The divers get their assignment to go after them. Then they take their boat to the location. Then they dive in. Then they just, the adventure kind of just unfolds from there. So it required very little work for me. I had a lot of legwork to go in the beginning to set up the situation, to set all the chess pieces in place. And then once they get into the water, it's like dominoes. The story just kind of falls itself. And Antonio drove us forward with the action and suspense that unfolded afterwards.
Well, they always say that the artist is the one that has to do the most that's involved. I mean, you can say a sea creature appears. And of course, now it's up to your artist to make that compelling and interesting visually.
100% true. So I did, as I said, I did a lot of the legwork in the beginning. There's a lot of talking going on as they needed to set the stage. And then, yeah, once they dive in, the dialogue is kept to a minimum. And Antonio does a great job driving us forward with all the danger that they encounter.
You know, so many writers are tempted to put a lot of words in these kinds of things, because as a writer, your job is to provide words and, you know, setting and all that stuff. And I think too many writers get into big word balloons, lots and lots and lots of words. And sometimes I turn a comics page and I look at this page. It's like gray blobs of text. And sometimes I literally go out and say, you know what? They'll explain things as we go along, and I pass that page by. You don't ever do that. That's a great thing about your writing. You're conscious of – it's more realistic. It's like, you know, in Spider-Man swinging through the sky, he's talking all the time. And so somehow everybody can hear him, and I'm always going like, well, I don't know if I buy that. And all these people who sit there and talk and talk and talk for page after page after page, I'm going like, you know, there'd be a lot better way to do this if something that was right to the point. And that's the thing about your writing that I always enjoy. You get to the point right away, and we are drawn in because of that. I don't get lost in the sea of words, to go back in the water allegory. I just, you know, your stuff is always right. It hits right on the head and gets us right to where we need to know. We learn exactly what we need to know for the story to move forward instead of this endless word blobs that I encounter on some books. And I just kind of look like and go, oh, you know, he must be getting paid by the word or something, because wow, there's lots of them. But I like the way that you do it better.
I appreciate that, Wayne. And, you know, it didn't come that way easy. I certainly took my lumps getting critiques and editors that say, what are you doing here? What are you saying? And I, you know what really helped me was when I started lettering my own work, because when I'm writing scripts, you know, scripts are the first pass, you know, you don't have no idea what it's going to look like on the page. So I do tend to overwrite sometimes, especially with dialogue and the scripts. But since I letter my own stuff, I have my hands on the actual words that are going on the page, the actual physical text. So I get to see my own words covering up the art. And I'm like, Frank, what are you doing here? So as I'm lettering, I'm also editing, and I cut words down so that to make the balloons as small as possible. And I got to figure out different ways to put it, so I'm not covering up the art. So I really feel that, you know, the crowdedness of the panels as I'm lettering, and I try to cut it down to a minimum.
Oh, see, that's one of the things that drives me insane, is when all these text blobs cover up the gorgeous art. And I'm going, boy, if that word balloon had been moved over just slightly, I could see what's going on. I do a video review series for a group, and they ask us to review or grade different levels. And the one thing I'm really critical of is the lettering. You know, when the lettering covers up stuff and makes it hard to understand what's going on, I just savage that. I give them a low grade on that, because I want the artwork. You know, here's this artist put all this time and creativity and made this stuff, and suddenly these text blobs end up on top of it. And I'm going, man, you know, if they had just shifted that just a little bit, we could have seen the illustrations and probably be pulled more into the story. But see, that's a good thing for you as a letterer is you look at when you see the artwork. And that's one question I do want to ask you about, too, about your reaction when you see the art. But I'm so glad that you do what you do and actually make the lettering complement the story instead of distract from.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really leveled up my comic creating was taking a lettering course and figuring out how to letter myself, because lettering is just, you really don't appreciate it till you try to go and do it yourself. You know, lettering is the one art form that is more successful the least it's noticed.
Yes.
It needs to be just seamless with the art. It needs to be one with the art and part of it. So great lettering is never appreciated. And bad lettering immediately ruins the comic because you notice it right away. So it's
That is so true. That's right on target because, you know, the best lettering is the kind you don't notice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't consider myself a phenomenal letterer in the slightest, but being able to letter my own work has given me a great appreciation when I'm reading some other books, either from the big two or from indies. And I really noticed the lettering in a way I never did before. And I love lettering so much because I feel like I really put the finishing touches on my own work, on my own pages. You know, I see that I write the scripts, so I'm there at the beginning. And after the artwork's all finished, I'm there at the end when I put the finishing touches on it. And it really feels like I bookend the project.
That's really cool because, like I said, I just savage lettering. That's probably the one I'm the most critical of, is the lettering of a book because it just so overwhelms the story and it so overwhelms the art and I get lost and it's just so distracting to me. So I'm so happy to hear that. I wish more people did it that way because it would make things so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, as a writer too, it makes editing my script so much easier because when I get a critique that says you got too many words on this page, I just say, yeah, I'll just worry about it when I'm like, you know, I never actually do it. I never do it in the actual script. Because I guess that's one of the benefits of lettering your own work. You know, if you're lettering somebody else's work, you gotta adhere to the script. That's your job, is to letter their words. But for me, I can abuse myself. I don't care about that.
Well, see, you've touched on something I think is also important to talk about. As a writer, you know, you see an artist and you deal with this, you give them the story that you want to tell. The thing I'm always interested in is the writer's reaction when they get the artwork.
I hear all the time about people getting so excited when they get art in their inbox. They're like, I can't wait to open it. I hold my breath. You know, I get super nervous when I get art in my inbox because I'm like, I wonder, I hope it looks good. I hope it's going to be the way I want it to be. So more often than not, it is great. It's because you got to be very selective with who you're working on the project. And the reason you work with somebody on the project is it's a little bit like a marriage, because you trust them. You got to have faith in them. If you're not going to have faith in them, what's the point of working with them anyway?
My experience as an indie, helping out with an indie comic was that way. I knew the story. We hadn't seen any art, and the guy who wrote the story was recruiting artists, and he got this one guy to do an illustration of one of the characters. And I remember looking at it and going, gosh, that's sort of blah. You know, here's this great big character. And this one, the first one we got, we looked at it and just kind of went, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't do anything for me. We knew when we had the right artist was when we got the illustration, that same character. And we just went, wow, look at that. That's real. It brought out all kinds of elements to the character that obviously the person thought about and brought into the character that, you know, a good artist can even augment the story on some levels. And I often hear writers say, when I got the artwork, I realized I could do that with it because there's this great thing going on, you know, that they've done with it. And they tickled my fancy along that way. And so I'm always fascinated by that. And after having gone through that experience of understanding it and seeing the art and, you know, finally starting to see it come together, it really, you know, it's an interesting thing for me, but not everybody does that. You're right. Is that, you know, it's, it's interesting because some people are just are very happy with it, but you have the story well fleshed out in your head, and so you may not, you know, it may not add things to it because you've got it so well developed in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think what helps me with this is that I'm also a prose writer. You know, I write novels, so I understand what it's like writing a story exactly how you want it to be. You know, because my words are directly consumed by the reader, which is that's what a prose novel is. Whereas with comics, I understand that I have to, as a storyteller, I have to swallow my pride a little bit and let the artist be the main storyteller, the one that's driving the narrative forward. And I can use that artist as a conduit to kind of tell the story that I want to tell, but it's going to be filtered through them. And the great artists, the ones who are really a blast to work with, are the ones that embrace that idea and then expand upon it. You know, I could describe the scene, but as they're writing the scene, you know, they can put little details in the body language that I didn't have in there because they understand what's going on in that particular moment. Or they might throw something into the background that adds subtext to it, you know, so they take whatever's going on, the story as I've described it, to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're starting out with somebody, do you find that you elaborate more? And then as you get together, as the two of you start working together and you begin to understand each other, you don't necessarily have to, in your mind, fill in the blanks so much. You can let them kind of do that.
A little bit. For my sake, I script a little bit more. I don't want to say detailed, but a little bit more directive. I'm a little bit more of a director than most people when they script. Because when I'm going through a story, especially when I'm reading a script, I need to have stage directions as far as camera directions goes. You know, whether it's a close up or whether it's a long shot or whether it's a side angle or what have you. And I put that in there simply for my own sake. When I'm telling the story, I need to have something in there. Otherwise, I feel like I can't make it work. But when I'm working with an artist, they know full well that if they have a better idea how to do that, they can just ignore me. Like I'm perfectly okay with that. They don't have to follow what I say. Very, very rarely do I correct it and I say, no, it has to look this way. And the reason I do that is because there's a storytelling purpose, a narrative reason as to why if they change it, it's going to change the way the story unfolds. But for the most part, I'm not an artist. I have zero design skills. So I really take a backseat to the artist's expertise, and they know if they can frame something a better way to draw out the most emotion out of a panel, by all means, go for it. You don't have to listen to me.
So I've touched on something that the book that I was the creator did the work that I'm the editor for. He would never tell me what was coming next. Okay. I get the script. And he wanted my reaction to it. You know, was that good? How did that hit you and stuff like that?
Sorry to cut you off, but you mean from issue to issue?
Yes.
Okay.
See, some people like do the whole story. You and your co-creator, he knows going in what the whole story is. Sometimes
I have
do you do that?
I have to storytell like that. I can't go from issue to issue. I mean, especially if you're working with an editor, the editor should know what the whole story is. You don't need to be surprised. I mean, they should be surprised when they're reading your synopsis, your treatment or your outline. But for the most part, yeah, the way I tell a story is you have a beginning, you have a middle and the end, you need to know what all those things are and you need to write it all out because you need to know what's going to happen because what happens if you get towards the end and you realize that there's a key detail that would change the story completely and you want to go back to the beginning and include it, you know, a little foreshadowing or something. I really need to have a full picture of how it's going to go down before I even start writing on page one.
Interesting, because you know the guy that I work with does not do that. He wants my reaction. He wants the artist's reaction. He's the only one that really knows the story. And so when I read the script, I give him feedback on what worked and what I thought didn't. There's one time he had this thing he wanted to be really funny, and when I got to it, I said, "Gee, I don't think it's funny enough." And then he had to go back and rework it so that it was funnier. And so you know, he was, you know, I'm kind of the first. the first taste of it. Now, if I don't go for it necessarily, doesn't mean I'm the ultimate judge, but he can kind of look at me and kind of say, well, if that didn't work, maybe I should rethink
something. I take it a step even further. Well, I'll take my synopsis and I'll break it down to a page outline. You know, I call it a page breakdown, where I know on every single page more or less what's going to happen. And that might change as I'm scripting, as I feel that more scenes, a scene needs to be longer or a scene could be shorter. And so it's a fluid thing, but for the most part, it's like an issue Bible that I know exactly how things are going to happen. And it really helps with pacing. You know, if I have a 20 page issue, I don't want one scene to be too long. So having that little blueprint of how I'm going to script it helps tremendously.
See, I think people who – and there's a lot of people who are now making indie books. And I always think that it's good to talk with folks about that, because your experience now has gotten you very far. You've done a lot of really great books. And I think there might be somebody who's just getting started and listening and thinking, I really want to do this, but I'm not exactly sure how. And you kind of have given some input that they can take, you know, and consider and work with. And – I think that's always a great thing. It's one thing about this podcast I always try to do is consider somebody brand new wanting to do this for the first time might want to understand the process.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the comics community, especially, is that there's no shortage of resources to learn. You know, whether it's crowdfunding or whether it's production or whether it's scripting or design or whatnot, there's tons of people out there that are willing to help you, tons of tutorials, tons of resources, tons of forums. I don't want to say that the author writing, the novel community is not as friendly or is not as helpful, but I feel like the resources are not as dense simply because it's just writing. You know, people say, well, how do I write? I'm like, I don't know, read some books, get a feel for somebody's voice, and then just give it a shot, you know? So it's comics creating is a lot more technical to that point where you can really provide a lot more tips to help people out when they're starting.
And as always, the best way to learn is to do it.
Absolutely. That's what I say. You just keep writing. Don't stop. Don't think about writing. Just keep doing it, because if you do it enough, you send it over to people, they'll tell you how to improve, and you just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're one of the writers out there that I think is going to really blossom, and I think the bigger company is going to start to take notice.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, Wayne. Thank you.
Because I think that there's a lot of great your development of characters, I think, is great. The surprises, like at the end of this first book, I think that there are people – that's, I think, sells great books, is when something unexpected happens. That's not that it's I always have to be careful when I say stuff like that, because I don't want something to hit me out of the blue. I want there to be some sort of build up towards it. But on the other hand, I want it to be something I didn't expect.
No, I get that complaint. I use the word complaint loosely a lot with my writing, as far as when it ends, people are frustrated because they want more. So I guess that maybe that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where I get that from. Maybe I get that from watching anthology shows that like to leave people on sour notes. So they're just kind of unhappy with the ending. But for the most part, when I tell a story like the Macabre Motel, everybody's first reaction was, what's going to happen next? How are you going to do another one? Well, when's the next one? I'm like, no, this is a one shot. That's all it is. So with this one, it's there is a second one. There is another one coming, and it will be later on, so you won't have to wait too long.
That'll be good. In fact, when I was looking at the Kickstarter page, your estimated delivery for the first issue is March.
Yes, and in all honesty, people will probably get it by the end of February.
Oh, cool.
And the only reason I put March is because the launch for my next book would be in April. So I'm like, I'm giving myself as much time as possible, because I, as a rule, my own personal rule, I don't want to launch anything until I've fulfilled the previous one. You know, I want to close the book on one campaign and move on to the next one without leaving anything open.
See, that's a great way to do it, because as I often say to people, and I think I've said many times on this podcast, I have backed something, and years ago I backed it, and I have yet to see that book. So I'm always happy when somebody gives me something and it's pretty reasonably quick. Well, you know, you gave me a preliminary copy of Polar Paradox a month or two back. So I was able to read it before. That's how I gave you the quote that I did, was because I really wanted to, you know, it's nice to be able to see things a little ahead of time and to work on it. I really appreciate people like you who believe in meeting the expectations of people who back you. I just think that's great.
Yeah. I mean, again, as a general rule, I don't launch anything until it's at least 90% done. And hopefully by the end of the campaign, it's going to be 100% done. As you said, this has been 100% done for a while. Issue 2 isn't 100% done. The artwork's still coming in. I've lettered about half the book, but I think it's summertime, so I think I got enough time to get it all wrapped up.
Now, of course, I always have to ask, you know, you talked about the Macabre Motel, and that one ended, people were expecting more, and that was your whole story. When this comes to an end, are you considering going back to the universe of the Polar Paradox, or is this going to is this a universe that you might want to visit again?
You know, it's funny you say that, and because we were talking about endings, because even the ending of part two, I feel it definitely leaves the door open, and is going to people are going to want to know what comes next. It does wrap up the arc, you know, it definitely wraps up the storyline, but it definitely ends on a note where people are going to not be 100% satisfied. They're going to want to know what happens afterwards, if something happens afterwards. So I've spoken to Antonio about it. I said, I'm not 100% happy with the ending. I would love to do a follow-up where we kind of really conclude it on a solid ground. And the way we're leaving it is we're going to see how these two campaigns do before we make a commitment to that. But knowing me, how I can't – I have writer OCD where I just can't leave that story out floating around. I plotted it out, so I know it's going to be another two-parter. And I know exactly what's going to happen, where it's going to be, how it's going to end, the characters are involved. It's just a matter of seeing how these two campaigns do and seeing what the reception is. And maybe I can convince Antonia to do another follow-up.
Is there ever a project that doesn't necessarily do well, but you love it so much you really want to keep going with it?
Maybe. It's possible.
I'm not saying that's this one. I'm just, you know, I'm just sort of interested because sometimes creators are in that world and they go, I really want to go back and do more of that. And, you know, it's, let's just say the support isn't as big as you might want it to be.
I would say yes. Yes, I would definitely do that. I would be open to doing that. At this junction, at this point in time, I would say in my career, I have to be able to finance books. I have to be able to keep the ball rolling. So if something's not working, I don't think I can try to continue with it. If I had a bigger fan base and I was more successful and I could afford to kind of go off on a tangent and work on a personal project that's not as that the fan base isn't as big, certainly. But for right now, I want to keep the momentum going and work on things that people are going to want to read.
You never know. You might hit it big at some point. And people say, wait a minute, what else has he done? And they'll go back and get us. You know what? I'd like to see more of that story. Well, yeah. You know, I've actually been thinking about that.
I never say never. That's my rule.
Good stuff. All right. So this is going to – let me make sure I get the conclusion time on here. This is going to conclude on Tuesday, February 2 at 11:59 Eastern time.
At the end of the day, end of Groundhog Day.
That's right. That'll be a good time to do that. And so by the end of that month, we might have all that good stuff. And I know you've got other projects coming. Do you want to tease any of that stuff, or do you want to hold that off until next time?
I sent out my to my mailing list. I sent out my 2021 email, letting everybody know what I got coming, so it's not a big secret. Polar Paradox is running now. Part 2 will be in the summer, in between, in the springtime,
around, as I said, April, I plan on launching a book called The Last Homicide, which is a detective murder mystery, kind of like a throwback to the old pulp noir crime mysteries. So it should be pretty fun.
Yeah, I love those kinds of things. I sit there and I turn on murder mysteries, and the next thing, the way they do those shows drives me crazy, because they get to the they do the conclusion, and then they don't give you a commercial break. They rush right into the next one, and I have found myself bleary-eyed hours of watching it because I can't turn off the television. They get me into another story that I got to know the ending of right away. And I I've got to be careful with mysteries like that. I literally have to, when I see the end, I have to click. Okay. Before you start, I've got to stop it. So I'm interested. I always love those kinds of things. So I'll have to stay tuned. Now, you mentioned that you have a mailing list. How do people get on your mailing list?
Sure. I'm really simple. I'm Frank the Writer. So you can find my website, franktherwriter.com. You could sign up for it there. I got all my comics. I got a whole bunch of free reads, you know, comics and short stories. And social media, too. I'm Frank the Writer. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, I'm at Frank the Writer is my handle for all of them.
So cool. So wherever you look for Frank the Writer, you'll find him out there, at least on the main ones. That'd be good. Now, of course, it's The Polar Paradox, number one of a two-part Make 100 sci-fi adventure. And again, it's going to conclude on Tuesday, February 2, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Do not wait. Frank is doing really well as we're talking about it. You're about three-quarters of the way there, it looks like. You have a goal of $2,500 as we're recording this, and hopefully by the time this posts, you'll be into stretch goals and things like that. That's what I'm hoping for.
Fingers crossed, Wayne.
Well, that's what we'll do. So anyway, that's a good thing. Don't wait. This is the time to jump on. Stop Frank from having those, the heart attack times when you turn on and you haven't looked, you refresh the screen and nobody has pledged in the last 5-10 minutes. Oh no, it's the end. It's never going to go anymore. Don't let that happen to Frank. Let's make these good things happen, because I always enjoy his work. So I really want to see more of it. So I'm very sure that The Polar Paradox is going to really do very well. And hopefully, if you can make enough, you may not have to do a second Kickstarter. We'll see. Mm-hmm. It's going to depend on how this one goes. So if you really like this kind of story and you want to see more of it, let's get in there and support it and maybe get him enough so he doesn't have to do another Kickstarter. We'll see about that for this one anyway.
Thank you, Wayne.
All right. So Frank, just keep it up, and I can't wait to see that one. We'll have to talk again when the next chapter, when your next book is coming.
Sure.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.